Yes, thanks very much, Neil. So hi everyone. As Neil introduced, I work at the University of Amsterdam, so GRAPPA Institute, Gravitational Astroparticle Physics Amsterdam. Started 10 years ago, and I've been there 10 years ago. I was one of the first people who joined there. Nice to see Subhadip, by the way. How are you doing? You're enjoying the new environment here? Yeah, he was a postdoc at the GRAPPA. Nice to see him.
Nice to see you as well.
Yeah. So today's talk is about my relatively new attempt. Can somebody, by the way, turn your camera on, maybe Neil or Subhadip, so that if I lose you, I can immediately see.
Right? Okay, sure, no problem.
Otherwise it's very hard. This is relatively my new attempt. Namely, the developing some semi-analytic models for the structure formation and the evolution of dark matter substructure. So since this is new, there may be lots of caveats, but I'm willing to take criticisms and the feedback in order to make those models more accurate and so on. So feel free to interrupt me and so on. Here are my major collaborators. So this effort started as my work together with Nagisa Hiroshima and Tomoaki Ishiyama, who are two of my fellow country people from Japan. We wrote the first paper together, and then a bunch of people are involved, especially those who are here are from all GRAPPA associate, ex-GRAPPA member and so on. Ariane, PhD student of mine, Camila postdoc, Kenny and Francesca were ex-GRAPPA, now doing faculty elsewhere. Richard Bottles was a very talented PhD student, unfortunately had to leave science. Some of the projects are involving the bunch of, I should mention Oscar Macias, Bradley Kavanagh. Oscar is a current GRAPPA postdoctoral fellow. Bradley was a very efficient postdoc, left GRAPPA a couple of years ago. Some effort is involving some bachelor students, master students. So that was a nice aspect of being a university faculty, being able to work with young, fresh people. I should mention that one of my important collaborators is Alex Geringer-Samet at Imperial College, who is an expert on the dwarf spheroid of galaxies. So we worked together to make a new model for the dwarf spheroid of galaxies. So then I should also make a little advertisement of the Dark Matter Consortium, which has started in Japan. This is made possible because of my affiliation at the Kavli Institute for the Physics and the Mathematics of the Universe, so-called Kavli IPMU. I'm an associated member, so is Neil, even though he may have forgotten by now, but he's a member, I am the member, so I'm involved in this program, and he is also involved in this program, in case he has forgotten. But, we are supposed to work on this dark matter problem in a very multi-diverse aspects, particle physics, astrophysics, and the cosmology, and then we got some decent amount of research budget to hire people. Most of the budget will go for the experiments and the observations and so on, but nevertheless, in my team, which is called CO2, which is supposed to work on cosmic structure, and then Neil is also part of it, we hired two postdocs. So this will continue until March 2025. So, and then my talk today will set the initial condition of this program, so to speak. Now, let me start from this sentence. Cold dark matter is well established and has all the observational support. So let's take a look at the image. Yes, that's true. So we can describe many observations. We have a bunch of dwarf galaxies and so on, but not quite. There are many, many substructures. We do not see them and so on. So maybe this is because of the baryons, maybe this is because of the new physics and so on, but at least I have to add a caption or footnote to this one. It's supported and well established, but only at large scales. So by large scales, I mean scales larger than galaxies, for example. Yeah, and then if you, on the other hand, look at the small scale structures, there can be variations, and then all of them can be consistent with observations. So I know that there are debates here and there. You know, people might not agree with each other all the time, but nevertheless, those are still open possibilities. So CDM, there are cusps in density profiles. Navarro-Frank-White profile, for example, can explain the density profile very well. You will also see very many small substructures in this image. You see lots of small dots here and there. And examples of CDM is like weakly interacting massive particle, a classic example of the classic candidate of the dark matter, which is getting less and less popular because of the lack of the evidence of a bunch of directions. Unfortunately, axions can behave as cold dark matter, axion-like particles, and primordial black holes, for instance. And warm dark matter, on the other hand, you can implement cutoff at subgalactic scales in the power spectrum. For example, one candidate can be stellar neutrinos and so on. Dark matter can interact with itself, so-called self-interacting dark matter. You will start having cores in the density profiles by the self-interaction, self-scattering. If the dark matter mass is extremely light, for example, 10 to the minus 20, 21 eV, on the other hand, you start seeing the pattern induced by the Dubloy wavelength. And then this Dubloy wavelength can be as large as the subgalactic scale. And then there you might start seeing the evidence of such a quantum state dark matter or fuzzy dark matter. So I call it FDM in this slide. So the example can be auto light bosons and so on. So let me go through some of the recent developments. So of course the satellite counts is one of the holy grails to constrain dark matter models. In this latest paper by Nadella et al., they basically looked at the number of satellites by the DES and the Pan stars and so on. And if you introduce the warm dark matter candidate, and if its mass is very light, it will suppress the number of satellites. And then at some point, it will become contradiction with the observation, because observationally you have hundreds of satellite galaxies in the measurement. Whereas if the number of subhalos predicted by those models is less than 100, this is not a good model anymore. So that's how people can constrain the mass of the dark matter. And then so is the FDM model. If it is very light, you see that, the Dubloy wavelength is long enough, but if this is too small, then you start seeing the suppression and things like that. So then they could put the constraint of warm dark matter of has to be like 6.5 keV. And if it's in case of fuzzy dark matter, it's 3 × 10⁻²⁰ EV or heavier. So that's a constraint. Now the other-
Can I ask about that? So are these constraints derived using simulations
I think so. Yeah, but this is, there are a couple of caveats in this because simulation, you have to connect the baryons to the dark matter somehow. And then they made some assumption in connecting the dark matter mass and the luminosity of the galaxy and so on. So they claim that this is a good model, but you have to be careful.
Okay, so they use something like abundance matching, you're saying to?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, great, thanks.
Yeah. Right. So then the stellar streams is another example. So you see the streams of the stellar system, like Sagittarius stream or whatever else. And then you see some gap, and the gap can be interpreted by the crossing of some baryonic structures, or can be interpreted as a crossing of the dark matter subhalo that we do not see otherwise. And then this is one of the Grappa paper, Nibanik, and then the Gianfranco Bertone analyzed this, and then this is the power spectrum of the density structure of this stream event. And then this is the data. And if you try to interpret by the crossing of the baryonic structures only, you cannot explain the power spectrum. Whereas if you include subhalos, you can you start explaining those. And then this way, once again, one can explain or exclude the dark matter mass to be heavier than 4.6 keV. So of course, this also comes with the caveat that this is based on the fitting functions of the simulation results, which are extrapolated below the resolution, current resolution scale. And then the gravitational lensing, Svadip?
Yeah, thanks. So in the previous slide, yeah, so what kind of baryonic physics you include? Like you use supernova winds and Asian feedbacks and stuff like that as well?
I do not know very well, to be honest, but I'm assuming that this is a crossing of some stellar system or something.
Okay. Oh. I'm just trying to understand that, is there a room for the leftmost curve to even match for some baryonic physics?
Sorry, what did you say?
So without sub halos, can we see some baryonic feedbacks which can still explain the data, or that room is completely blocked off?
I think that's what they claim in this paper, but yeah, I cannot be 100% sure. You really have to look
at that paper. Good. Yeah. Thanks.
So as a care.
Yeah, on that paper, I think it's less about feedback processes, but like baryonic structures. So they have a disk and a bar, and then they have globular clusters. And these are the sort of things that are included in simulation.
Okay, yeah, thanks for helping me. Great. Okay, so the gravitational lensing. So yeah, you look at the image of the lensed galaxies and so on, but if there is a perturbation of this on this lensed image, people can conclude that this must be the effect of dark matter substructure and so on. And then similarly, you can start excluding the mass of the dark matter, warm dark matter mass, for example. And then in this work, which is relatively recent, the mass of dark matter, it's probably hard to see, but it's constrained to be, warm dark matter mass is constrained to be heavier than 5.2 kV or something. That's similar to what other people are claiming, but 5-ish kV or heavier seems to be the current consensus in this field, even though these two results are, once again, obtained by fitting functions of the simulation results, and the simulation results had to stop around 2.5 kV warm dark matter mass, and then people cannot handle very well the heavier than that, apparently, because of the resolution issue, I suppose. People started discussing the more and more the small scale primordial power spectrum. So vanilla inflation tells us that this is scale invariant power spectrum, but no one really has tested this at small scales. Of course, this has been tested at large scales, as this plot shows. Everything blue here is already excluded by the CMB measurement or large scale structure measurement, including Lyman alpha. So the power spectrum, primordial power spectrum, is tightly constrained. Excuse me. Oh yeah. In this narrow range, so that's why everything is consistent with a single power law inflationary model. But the possibility is wide open at small scales, simply because we don't have much measurement. There are some constraints over here, like PBH constraints, CMB mu distortion, and so on. But still, this can behave very strangely in small scales related to some weird physics in the early universe and so on. And if that's the case, you might see the bump in the power spectrum, and you might see lots of substructure. And then if there are lots of substructure at small scales with small masses, then you might be able to see using different probes like pulsar timing array. And then in this paper, they discussed some possibility of constraining small scale structure using pulsar timing array measurements in the future. Now, of course, this is one of the very first attempts. So although this is extremely important direction to explore, I have to say that, you know, they have just used a simple analytic prescription in order to get the, you know, all those constraints. I'm sure that the, you know, people will make the model more and more accurate in the near future though. So coming back to this, this gives us the goal, scientific goal, to develop models of small scale structure formation and then possibly apply them to various dark matter candidates. Because, you know, people are looking for dark matter through various directions, like, you know, collider experiments, direct detection experiments at the, you know, underground level, looking for the scattering of WIMPs with nuclei, and the indirect detection, looking for the annihilation of dark matter particles, yielding lots of gamma ray photons and so on. But none of them really told us what the dark matter is made of. So that's really unfortunate. So the only evidence we have is gravitational, or, you know, small scale, yeah, structure formation information and so on. So this might keep being the only probe to identify particle nature of dark matter in the next decade or so. So this could be still keeping being the one of the most important directions in the next decade or so. So my ambition here is to develop some semi-analytic models and then calibrate with numerical simulation results, and then establish reliable models, which is free from shot noise and the numerical resolutions. That's what I am going to tell in the rest of my talk. So let me walk through what path I was going along, where all this effort started. So this is this started with my 2015 paper, already 6-7 years old. I was a guy who was interested in WIMP annihilation. You know, I had worked on lots of, developing lots of statistical probes like power spectrum correlation in order to find the WIMP dark matter through the gamma ray measurements, largely by the Fermi Gamma Ray Deep Space Telescope, which was launched like, is that 13 years ago already? Oh my goodness, 13 years ago. Besides Fermi discovered lots of important astrophysical objects, it didn't find dark matter, yeah. Of course, if you talk about the gamma ray telescopes, you are talking about WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. And if it's WIMPs, people often talk about the particle annihilation. So annihilation of two dark matter particles, emitting photon, annihilating into some final states like BB bar or quark-quark pair or gauge boson pairs and so on. They will eventually giving us lots of gamma ray photons and so on. And then in principle, the Fermi was looking for annihilation of the photons that's coming from the dark matter annihilation. Now, I was in this field, and then the one concern that I had for so long time was that the halo masses range 20 orders of magnitude. It's the WIMPs. The largest guy is a cluster of galaxy. And then the smallest guys, guess what? It can be as light as Earth. You know, it's micro solar mass. So this can range 20 orders mass in the magnitude. And then you have to understand the properties of halos in this wide range of 20 orders magnitude in terms of mass. So that was an enormous challenge. And then people tries to explore smaller and smaller scales using numerical simulations. At some point, people stopped doing that because, you know, people immediately recognized that, you know, baryonic physics is more important to explore. The baryonic physics will probably play some role around 10 to the 10 to the 9, 10 to the 8 solar mass objects. That's where galaxies form. And then that's extremely important to address. So that it makes sense that, you know, people change this the direction to explore that baryonic physics much more. But unfortunately, the resolution wise, people had to stop around 10 to the 5 solar masses. And then that was the situation more than 10 years ago. And then observationally, of course, you cannot probe 10 to the 5 solar mass objects yet. I mean, people start talking about 10 to the 8, 9 probably, but not as, nowhere near the smallest scale that we are interested in. However, the problem Yeah, so this is what I said already. The problem is that the WIMP annihilation, if you want to understand WIMP annihilation, it's really sensitive to halos of all scales. So here is a little formula. So I'm talking about the gamma ray luminosity from annihilation. And then this L of M is a gamma ray luminosity of this entire Milky Way structure. And then L subhost of M is the luminosity if there were no substructure. So you recognize all those small substructure on top of the main structure, which is represented by this brightest spot of the galactic center, halo center, and so on. But besides that, you have smoothly distributed Navalny-Frank white-like structure in there. And then on top of that, you have a bunch of substructure. If you remove that, you have this L host, which is relatively straightforward to compute. However, you have lots of small scale substructure, and then you have to accommodate, take them into account in the calculation of luminosity. Then the second term is the luminosity due to the substructure, which is often described by this ratio, a boost factor, what we call boost factor. And the boost factor is simply the integral of mass function multiplied by each luminosity of subhalo. And then since this integral goes from 10 to the minus 6 solar mass, for example, up to large scales, if you're talking about galaxies, it can go as high as 10 to the 11 solar masses and so on. Everything contributes to this integral. And then what people have done was not very satisfactory. And then people just said that, look, we resolved this. So by the way, this is the gamma ray surface brightness profile as a function of radius of a cluster of galaxy and so on. And then this red curve is the smooth component of the NFW. And then this blue dots are the subhalo components, which are resolved. And then people have just extrapolated down to Earth mass and so on, and then concluded that you would expect the luminosity this high if you take into account all the subhalos and so on. So this was done by using the phenomenological power law extrapolation. And then by the way, if the minimum mass is 10 to 12, minus 12 solar masses instead of 10 to minus 6, and then you get even higher. This was the situation back in 2012 and even 2017, people are still adapting on two different slopes of subhalo mass function, either m to the minus 1.9 or m to the minus 2. Since we have to extrapolate so large dynamic range, only a small difference of the tilt can make relatively huge difference. So you see that factor of 10 difference in terms of boost factor. So just to remind you, boost factor is the luminosity due to subhalo divided by the luminosity of the host. So if this is 10, the subhalo component is 10 times brighter than the host component and so on. So this clearly tells you that, we basically don't understand anything, and that we don't even understand how uncertain this estimate is, even though we say that this must be very, very uncertain. So, and then I was not very happy about that. And I was hoping that somebody have worked on that, but apparently nobody had worked on that until that point. When I decided to work on this myself. And then I had this idea of developing semi-analytic models of subhalos because of those motivation. I wanted to provide complementary tools to the numerical simulation. I wanted to make those tools light, flexible, and versatile, and then can cover a large range of halo masses, hopefully from micro halos to cluster size halos, and the large range of redshifts, 0 to 10 or so, based on physics modeling, not the phenomenological extrapolation. Of course, one caveat is that if it's fully analytic, people can be critical that, I don't trust your model. So I have to really convince people that this is reliable. And then in order to do that, I have to cross-calibrate with the simulation results that people trust. So this was the goal. And then if you think about the structure formation, it's surprisingly well understood. So it's very simple procedure. If I put it this way, in reality, it can be much more complicated, I'm sure, but I do not go into that, you know, first order, second order correction. I'm talking about the zeroth order, you know, simplest storyline. So structures form, and then that's based on the primordial power spectrum, you know, which sets the initial condition. And then the structures do form from the smallest one, and then to create bigger one through merger or accretion. And then that's described by the formalism called extended projector theory or excursion set theory. So there is a formalism or theory, theoretical framework, which is established in the field of cosmology. And once the smaller guy fall onto the bigger guy, subhalos simply experience the mass loss through the gravitational force and so on. And then that's where you need to model the tidal shipping and the mass loss rate. So all you need to do is to understand all those, each of these three processes, and then they seem to be well understood, you know, back in 2014, 2015, when I started working on this. So the task was just, you know, bringing all pieces together in a one coherent model. That's very nice. Because, for example, subhalo accretion, I'm talking about the second step here, accretion and the merger. This is a number of subhalos accreted on the bigger guy per given mass range, per given redshift range. And then those curves are the models. Those dots are the simulation results of the 10 to 12 solar mass objects and the 10 to 14 solar mass objects. And then extended projector theory gives you a very simple theoretical equation to describe many of these surprisingly well. So there were, I'm sure that there were some, you know, fitting parameter to be tuned, but and so on, but that's okay. I mean, it's surprising that, you know, they can do that with this relatively simply looking formula. That makes me very happy. And now subhalo evolution. After subhalo accrete onto the host, I had to work on this. And then we decided to use the Monte Carlo approach in order to describe the halo, subhalos from very small scales to the relatively big guys. So the Monte Carlo approach that we took is that we determine orbital energy and the angular momentum through the Monte Carlo. Okay, Subhadip, you have a question?
Yeah, right. So in the previous slide, what was MS? Sorry, I missed that. These different lines are for what thing? That MS?
Oh, MS is the subhalo mass divided by the host mass, the ratio. Mass,
okay, thanks.
All right, so this Monte Carlo approach, you determine the orbital energy and the angular momentum using some distribution, which is calibrated by the simulation. Once you determine the orbit, you fix the orbit by assigning energy and the angular momentum, right? So by doing so, you can say that the where is the pericenter. And then you assume that everything outside of the tidal radius at the pericenter is stripped away. And that's the mass that's lost. And then you know the mass loss, the amount of mass which is lost in one period, and then you know you can calculate the period. And then that's how you can calculate the M dot. So that's mass loss rate. And then you repeat this through lots of energy and the angular momentum that's subtracted from some distribution. And then you make a plot, and those are cyan points here. And then I compared with the simulation results by the Tomoaki Ishiyama's simulation, and then those are there. And then, yeah, I was comfortably surprised how well this very simple-minded approach makes the agreement with the simulation. Of course, there are. So this is the 10 to the 13 solar mass at the redshift 0. This is 10 to the 7 solar mass host halo at the redshift 5. And the x-axis is the subhalo mass, by the way, divided by the host halo. And then this is the 10 to the minus 2 solar mass host at the redshift 32. So this simple prescription can describe, of course, you have this agreement by a factor of 3, but, you know, I'm talking about, you know, redshift 32, 10 to the minus 2. So I was happy enough to see this much agreement.
Sorry, can I ask, so what's being plotted here? Is this like the m dot for some particular object? Like Warren said, is this like some sort of average over lots of subpayloads?
Yeah, or? Average over some. So from simulation, I think this is average over some time, some dynamical time or something.
Over like a population of subhalos that are in some host.
Yeah, you pick the some subhalo with a given mass, with a specified mass, and then calculate how much mass was lost from this guy. Yeah, in this given per this given time, and then that's your m dot, and that's what you can get from the simulation.
Okay, and these like vertical extent. Like,
oh, these are, yeah, this is distribution, like this is, yeah, 50% containment or 90% containment or something like that. I don't remember the detail. I have to go back to this paper to be sure, but something like that.
Okay, yeah, so it's like the scatter in the population, I see.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. And does your Monte Carlo also give you some sort of estimates, like for the scatter in the population?
Oh, yeah. So those are the scatter, right? So, but, you know, for this first attempt, we didn't talk about this scatter, but, you know, I realized that this is something we must do at some point because the scatter seems to be intrinsically smaller than the simulation, as you see. You know, simulation tells you this big is the, you know, this much is the scatter size, but Monte Carlo seems to say that the scatter is much smaller. That's clearly not what we want for the most accurate model. That needs to be addressed in the future work. Nevertheless, we got all the check marks here in those three processes. So these two were done before, and then we had to work on this. Oh, the good thing about doing Monte Carlo is that it's computationally so inexpensive that you can use a wider range of subhalo mass. So for example, one can do the experiment assuming the much lighter subhalo mass, like 10 or minus 15 in terms of mass ratio compared to the MHOS. So that's impossible to do the with the simulations. You know, simulation have to stop around 10 or minus 5 in terms of mass ratio, but the Monte Carlo approach don't suffer this problem. So once you calibrate, once you're confident that your model is reasonable, then you can more or less trust that this model is good to be extrapolated down to a much smaller masses. Yeah. And then we have all the check marks here, and then the rest is just to combine. And then the output of combining those ingredients is, there are several outputs, but you know, for example, let's take a look at the subhalo mass function first. So that's a number of subhalos in the host as a function of mass. So DNDM as a function of mass, where mass, I mean subhalo mass, not the host mass. But if the host is something like galaxy size halo or cluster size halo, you have subhalo mass function like this. So these solid curves are our prediction. And then these dashed curves are the Tomoaki Ishiyama's simulation. And then these are the results from a few of the classical papers. So yeah, they seem to agree quite well. I mean, you might argue that there is some discrepancy here and there, but you know, some of them can be addressed by the shot noise and so on of the simulation side, maybe. But point is, these are all physical models. So this is not an extrapolation. Yeah. And then I can do this for the galaxies at the higher redshifts 2 and 4. Then you have some comparison here, and then there is some mismatch here. But, you know, I mean, given what people have done in the past, this was not the major problem for me at that point. And then if you talk about the dwarf scale galaxies, like 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 solar masses at the redshift 5, yeah, I found this agreement and I was very happy to see this. 10 to the 7 solar mass, this one, 10 to the 6 solar masses, this one, and then I have a nearly perfect agreement between my prediction, our prediction and the simulation. So let me emphasize, we don't have any parameter to tune. You know, every model is given by the previous work. You know, we have extended projector formalism, and then we have mass loss prescription. All the parameters are fixed there. And then we combine, and then this is the outcome. There is no free parameter to play with. Yet I saw this much agreement, which made us very, very happy, and then become confident. So yeah, question?
Hi, yeah. So the semi-analytic formalism you have, does it account for baryonic effects for low?
No, not at the moment.
Ratios?
No.
Okay.
That's so, clearly one caveat I recognize, yeah.
Yeah, so the argument you make for not trusting the simulations is not that you don't trust the physics of the simulations, but that it's not worthwhile running very high resolution simulations because the baryonic effects induce uncertainty. Would that be a fair summary of what you're arguing?
So I recognize the importance of variance, that's for sure. But, you know, I wanted to, so this is one issue. The other issue is that, you know, how far one can go down in terms of, you know, scales. So, and then if you go smaller and smaller scales, baryonic effect, I suppose, is getting less and less important for such smaller scales. That's another direction. So that's the direction I am taking here. So that's why I am comparing all my results with the dark matter only simulation, not the hydro ones.
So then my question is, what is the reason not to compare to dark matter simulations on small scales, low mass ratios? Is it just the resolution issue?
Yeah. It's just a resolution issue. There is simply no data available.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Oh yeah, so this is about the mass. So I didn't mention the internal structure. So what about the internal structure? So let's assume that the internal structure is well described by the NFW profile. Yeah, that's probably a big assumption, but you know, there's no other way at this point, right? I mean, people might argue that the iNASTO is a better profile, but you know, at this level, NFW is probably fine. If you take NFW, you have RS and rho S as described in this equation, which many of you must be familiar with. Then what's the distribution of rho S and RS of each individual subhalo? Yeah. So this is the probability density of our theoretical model, the red contour, whereas green dots are the VLACT-2 numerical simulation. That's an ancient numerical simulation, dark matter only simulation, but nevertheless, you see dots here from the relatively massive subhalos in the parameter space of rho S and RS. And then if you reduce the mass, you start seeing more and more subhalos, and then you start seeing more and more dots here. And for all those cases, I see great degree of agreement, which made me very, very happy. Of course, there are some outliers which our model cannot describe very well, but you know, relatively speaking, number of outliers are very, very tiny. So at this level, I convinced myself that this model is good enough to proceed. Yeah. So here's a short summary of the model that I have developed so far, that I have described so far. So I wanted some benchmark models for CDM / WIMP. That's free from resolution. So that can be used without being bothered by the resolution issue. And that's free from shot noise that can be useful for large mass ranges. I come to that point later on as one of the applications. And the model should be well tested against the numerical simulations of halos with various masses at various ratios. That's precisely what I showed in earlier slides. And that model should enable quick implementation. And often this is very crucial to survey through parameter spaces for different dark matter models. So sure, this is probably not the problem for CDM and WIMPs because there is no parameter, you know, gravity, that's it. Yeah, you don't have any parameter. However, if you talk about different dark matter models, well, dark matter, warm dark matter, self-interacting dark matter, quantum state dark matter, those models always come with parameters, free parameters, which we do not know. And then for every single set of parameters, you have to run the simulation and so on. That's costly. However, if you have a good model that can describe dark matter properties relatively quickly, that will be enormously helpful. That's my hope. That's not the state as of now, but that's what I want to go in the end of the next 5 years or so. Let me move on to the application. So let's talk about the annihilation booster factor. So let me remind you, the booster factor is defined as a subhalo luminosity divided by the host luminosity, how bright the subhalo component is compared to the host component, if WIMPs or CDM annihilates into each other to make gamma rays and so on. So this is a booster factor as a function of host mass. And this is my prediction. If you go larger and larger for dark matter mass, halo mass, it's order of one. Yeah. And then even for galaxy clusters, it's 10 to the 15. It's still factor of three. So the subhalo is contribution is as bright as host to galaxy, but not much. Unlike what people were claiming. Like sometimes people say that, you know, factor of 100, factor of 1000 boost is expected, but that's clearly not the case. Neil?
Sorry, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what about subhalos of subhalos?
Oh, yeah. I did take into account. So this is including subhalos in the model. This can be taken into account in an iterative way. That's very modest. I would say tens of percent only.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Can I also ask, on the left-hand plot, you're showing like the time evolution, I guess, of this boost factor.
Right, that's right. Redshift one, halos at redshift one, two, and three, and four. Yeah.
And so why is it that, you know, so for like very low mass hosts, for example, you know, like why at redshift zero do you see like the boost factor getting so much smaller than it is at like redshift one?
I suspect that this is due to the tidal stripping that will change the internal structure as well, which makes subhalos less and less bright for individual subhalos.
Like, but for hosts of like 10 to the 6 solar masses, you know, or even smaller, right? So those hosts form themselves at very high redshift. And I'm just surprised.
Okay, but many of the subhalos accrete at the relatively low redshift as well, right?
Even for this 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 solar masses, really? I mean,
I think so. I think that's what's happening. I mean, there are a bunch of field halos, which is as low as, you know, those low masses. Yeah. And then they accrete relatively at the low redshift, I suppose.
Well, I mean, like, you know, at these very low host masses, the mass accretion rates for those halos become very low at low redshift.
Hmm.
I'm just missing something about like why there's such strong redshift evolution.
Okay. I'll probably have to look into the details of the codes and so on to understand. I mean, have to do some couple of tests to provide a precise answer. But my understanding was just that tidal stripping.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Question. What is the minimum mass that you're assuming here?
10 to the minus 6 solar masses.
10 to the minus 6. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So the second application, so the dwarf satellite galaxies. So we have a bunch of dwarf satellite galaxies in our Milky Way system. So I mentioned this in one of the introductory slides. We have probably hundreds of dwarf galaxies on them, but major ones can be used to constrain dark matter properties like WIMP annihilation and so on. There, people use this jargon called J factors. And then J is nothing but a line of sight integral of the density squared. Density squared is important because we are talking about the annihilation of two dark matter particles. So that's why this is not density, but density squared, right? So, and then the, so there, of course, you have to understand the density profile in order to make the precise estimate of this J or accurate estimate of this J. For that, you have to rely on the kinematics data. And then people once said that the J factors of promising dwarfs are 10 to the 19 GeV squared per centimeter fifth or larger. Please keep this figure in mind, 10 to the 19 in this weird unit. I keep using this. But you see that ultra-faint dwarfs do not host many stars. So once people was once saying that, you know, ultra-faint dwarfs are most promising when you're interested in finding dark matter annihilation. And then I was puzzled, why is that? They are supposed to be less massive, hence this should give fewer gamma ray photons. And then I wanted to understand. And then now I think I have an answer finally. I had to wait like, you know, for 5 years or more to, you know, give the proper answer. But now I think I have the answer. But anyway, let me go through this. So if you look at the segue one, and then you see, I mean, those ones with green circle are the member stars. And then imagine you determine density profile by looking at the motions of those stars, which are very few. This is not rich data. And then what do we do? People estimate rho s and rs of the density profile. Well, you assume an FW, for instance. You don't have to, but it makes your life easier if you do. Rho s and rs are two parameters of most importance. But nevertheless, if you do not have many data, that's not sufficient to constrain rho s and rs in a satisfactory manner. Then people rely on Bayesian statistics, right? So Bayesian statistics is that prior multiplied by likelihood, that's your posterior. But it's well known fact that if the data are not constraining, the posterior depends on your prior choices. If you choose different prior, you get a different posterior, right? If the data are constraining, on the other hand, you don't have this problem. You know, whatever you choose for your prior, you get the same answer or more or less the similar answer. And then people have used the uniform, log uniform priors for rho s and rs, just saying that these are agnostic choices. And that's what I am going to question. On the other hand, doing frequentist way is very challenging. This can be done, but this was done only for classical dwarfs, which are very massive, very bright, but not for the ultra-faint dwarfs. So here is the impact of prior. So so here's a rho s and rs panel. And then the if you do not have many data points, that's what you get as a likelihood contour. You cannot break the degeneracy between rho s and rs. I mean, this is what you are allowed to have purely by the data. And then these green contour is the log of J factor. So I said that the most promising dwarfs are, you know, 10 to the 19 in this unit. So this likelihood contour clearly allows 10 to the 20 GV squared per centimeter fifth or so. Or if you go here, yeah, you have crazy value, 10 to the 23, 24, 25. That allowed purely by the data. And then what do? People just use the cosmological arguments to chop off the top end of this range. However, they keep using the flat log uniform prior to constrain. So of course, for sure, this will erase those range that gives you the very high J factor values. But everything down here is still remain. And then this can be dangerous because this is your choice, you know, not the, what the data shows. on the other hand, if you have subhalo models, that it can replace this argument of chopping off the top region with the much more realistic distribution, density distribution of those parameters. That can be your prior. And then that's the contour, white contour here, or the red heat map here. And then the satellite, what we call satellite prior, does this job naturally. And then it can help break the degeneracy between those parameters. And then once you have prior likelihood, you have the posterior. Yeah, and then that's my posterior. Instead, if you choose, if you have chosen the flat prior, you would have this banana shape like posterior still. So that makes a difference. And I have to emphasize that this is very hard to achieve with the simulations because yeah, it's limited, but the amount of data is limited and the constructing the probability distribution from the numerical simulation is very challenging. Probably not impossible, but it takes a lot of effort in order to implement that. So that's where, then once you have the distribution of rho s and the rs, it's relatively straightforward to extract the distribution of j. And so these are the relatively promising dwarf galaxies with some major Segway 1, reticulum 2. And then these gray posterior distribution is what the earlier people were claiming. And then, yeah, like I said, people are saying that 10 to 19, 10 to 20 in this unit is the what the most promising dwarfs are telling us, giving us, but it has to get shifted towards lower values because of this, you know, once you fix the prior, now it's weaker. Yeah, and then this is the complete list of various dwarfs comparing various models and so on. And then once you combine all those, I mean, people have done the joint likelihood analysis of the various dwarf galaxies in order to obtain the WIMP annihilation cross-section constraints as a function of WIMP mass. And this was a previous constraints, log uniform and the cosmological argument. And then these are the new limits depending on the models of satellite formation and so on. So this will push back the WIMP limits towards higher values, or weaken the sensitivity of the dwarf search of the WIMP annihilation. Now the thermal cross section of this value, for those who don't know this one, this is the value that's believed to be the most reasonable value for the WIMP annihilation cross section. And then the goal of this business is to exclude this value up to as high as possible in terms of WIMP mass. Now people were, people were once saying that, this value was excluded up to 150 GeV, but because of this argument, it's excluded only up to 20 to 50 GeV. So the possibility is still wide open. These arguments are relevant also for CTA, Cherenkov Telescope Array, which is next generation gamma ray telescopes. It's not strictly the successor of the Fermi because it's covering the different energy range. It's more sensitive to the higher mass WIMP candidates. But we look forward to what the CTA will see in the near future. Oh, WINO dark matter, for example, we applied the same methodology for WINO. And we can do the prospects for LSST. Unlike earlier work, which were claiming that with LSST, you would improve the cross-section limits by factor of 10. It's gonna be fantastic. But realistically, I could do this using our subhalo model in a sober way. And then our prediction is that yeah, LSST wouldn't dramatically increase the number of dwarfs and hence the limits of annihilation cross-section in the near future. So I realize that I'm running out of time, so let me skip the application three, but we also analyzed some Gaia data and so on, and then concluded that, apparently no Fermi. So there were Fermi unassociated gamma ray sources that were claimed to be the source of WIMP annihilation, but we concluded that no, that's not the case based on the subhalo argument. Then, so that's what we have done for the CDM side, but you know, of course, as I said, my ambition is to expand this model to different dark matter candidates, and that the warm dark matter is the second simplest model. And that's what we are doing. And we had to modify here and there our models, and then changed the quantities like delta C or sigma of M for those values for dark matter, and then others unchanged, and then run the code again, and then got the Vmax distribution on the satellite and so on. This is what we got for various warm dark matter masses. And then this is what the earlier work by Mark Lovell and the collaborators did using the simulation. So they seem to match quite well. So I am looking forward to submission for this work in the near future. So to conclude, a small scale distribution dark matter has been essential, and that this can still keep being one of the most essential tools in determining different particle dark matter candidates. And then I think we have a benchmark models for CDM/WIMP. Although there are still remaining tasks to be made to make the models more accurate and so on. And I see that there are lots of applications. I'm still looking for applications. If you have ideas, please feel free to share. I'm happy to talk. So we did apply for the annihilation boost factor, dwarf density profiles, and so on. And of course, my ambition for the next several years is to extend this model to different dark matter candidates, warm dark matter, self-hindered dark matter, fuzzy dark matter, or test some inflation models, including small scale primordial power spectrum or primordial black holes. Yeah, that's all. Yeah, thanks very much for your attention.
Okay, great. So let's all unmute. I have to give him a round of applause for his very interesting talk. Okay, we've had a bunch of questions, but we have time for a few more. So please just jump in. I see that Larry has already raised his hand, so please go ahead.
Thanks, it was a really interesting talk. I wonder if you've tried to apply, take this off, your semi-analytic model to scale-free cosmologies. Mm-hmm. And in particular, when you get to the small scale end of CDM, and the slope of the power spectrum is n equals minus 3, then things become very pathological, and you know everything's sort of collapsing on the same time, and okay. And simulations become hopeless. And I wonder if your semi-analytic can give some insight into this.
Well, quick answer: we have not tested. So, in fact, it's my first time to hear about this. What's the model? Say that again, please.
Just a scale-free power spectrum. There's one parameter, the slope of the primordial power spectrum. There are classic, simulations by Birchinger that go way back.
Okay, good point. If you let me know a bit more detail about the model, I would love to see, investigate a bit more to see if this is something we can apply our models to.
It's sort of an academic exercise, but it might be interesting. I'll mute my dog now.
Okay. Kier, did you want to go next?
Thanks, Neil. Yeah, thanks for the great talk. Very, very interesting. I just wondered if you thought about a lot of observations of ultra-faint dwarfs. There's some claims of sort of dark matter absent galaxies, and there certainly seems to be like a wide diversity in the properties of ultra-faint dwarfs. Would your model be able to predict the existence of all these different kinds of dwarf galaxies?
At this moment, no. I mean, of course, if it's a CDM, you do not have that much variety. And then the people are saying that these varieties or diversity is made by the baryons. So that's one thing. The second possibility is that, you know, people are claiming that self-interacting dark matter can make the diversity, but that also involves baryonic component to make the diversity. So either way, I have to make my model to be able to handle baryons. But right now, I cannot do that.
Okay, no worries. Cheers, thank you.
Subhadeep, do you want to go next?
Thanks. Excellent talk, Shejira, very interesting. I have two questions. One is related to what you have just now mentioned. So that is regarding, do you see how you're going to improve including baryonic FS in your analytical model?
Good question. No clear answer for now, to be honest. I'll have to think about it very carefully. If you have any idea, please.
Good talk, yeah. I have one more question regarding your posterior distribution on J on rho A's and RS.
Yeah.
So there, the rate contours are obtained for CDM. Is that correct?
Right. That's right.
So, I mean, what I was thinking, yeah. So what is the room for going beyond CDM models and how much this rate posterior area will change?
Right. So it will cut some range. I mean, if we, for example, discuss a warm dark matter, it will cut some range of rho S and RS parameter space, but this can be done. I haven't done, but this should be straightforward. Some region will be cut out.
Yeah, I think
if it's warm dark matter, for example.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So there will be some more constraining power depending upon the model of dark matter you're choosing.
Yeah, exactly. But if you talk about J factor, you are talking about a CDM WIMP. So
yeah.
That's why
we have already. Yeah. I see. Good. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay. I think next was Niyash.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the talk. So I have one question regarding your model of tidal stripping. So I was just wondering whether, I mean, how does this tidal stripping of subhalos go on? Like, do they, if I look at a subhalo long enough, it would just completely disappear? Or will it approach some sort of a asymptotic mass?
Good point. I do not know if it decreasing, if its mass keep decreasing and so on, and eventually disappear, because at some point it reaches the present epoch, right? It's at some point the present epoch, and then that's the end for now. But if they already hit the plateau by the time it reaches the present epoch or not, I'm not sure. Maybe somebody else knows this.
The question is kind of the nature of tidal stripping, because really, I mean, all the tidal stripping models are extrapolations to some extent, because your simulations have a finite duration, mm-hmm. and you see what happens there. And then from there on, you either have to assume that it keeps getting smaller in principle, if you follow it long enough, you could see whether it does reach a plateau or not. But I mean, at least early on, I remember people assume they just disappear. And then there was some change of there was kind of, I mean, better simulations, higher resolution simulations saw that you kind of reach a plateau, and I'm not quite sure which one it is that you are using.
So we are assuming that the mass keeps decreasing with a constant rate of m dot, and then they seem to describe the simulation pretty well. Mm-hmm. So okay. Yeah.
No, but, okay. So this is
something I have to look into.
Good. And I actually think maybe Go might have looked at this at some point with his PhD supervisor. I don't know if he's still in the audience, or maybe he's not in the audience anymore. So I just wanted to then point out that around the same time that you came up with your model, we also had an alternative approach based on a stable clustering in the phasor space. This was
I recognize that work. Yes.
And the key difference between these is the question, I mean, do you think your subhalos disappear, or do you think subhalos reach a stable status?
I see.
And of course, I mean, I think it's a bit hard and depends really on the resolution of simulation, because In fact, if you don't have high enough resolution, your subhalos could overstrip, because mm-hmm. I mean, if the particles become too few, then it cannot really hold together. So we also did all the calibration against simulations, but it was a different language. It wasn't in terms of subhalos, it was in terms of correlation functions in the phase space.
I see, yeah.
And I think basically, I would argue that the jury would still be out on this, because really the question is, how do you think the stripping proceeds? If the stripping gets stopped at some point, then you have a stable structure, and that could still boost, boost, if you will.
I see, okay.
Mm-hmm. But if they all disappear, then of course, then you would have, you don't get a very big boost.
Right, okay, interesting. Yeah, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and the next is James.
Hey, thanks for a great talk.
Thanks.
I think it was your collaborator, Ishiyama, who did some simulations of very, very early halo formation mm-hmm. on very small mass scales.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things, we looked at this issue of the annihilation rate and the boost factor a couple of years ago with Nyayesh and with a student, Chiamaka Okoli. And one of the things we noticed was that if you look at the physical density in those very high redshift simulations,
right.
You know, just the solar masses per cubic mm-hmm. parsec, mm-hmm. it's very high. And if you extrapolate concentration mass relations from low redshift, the way mm-hmm. people usually do, down to the 10 to the 6, you wind up predicting physical densities that are much lower.
Okay.
By a factor of, you know, maybe 5 or 10.
Okay.
So that, I just, you know, that kind of interests me. I think that's an outstanding question, is what is the physical density of these things? And people usually think of it in terms of the concentration mass relation.
Mm.
But of course, that's not studied directly over that many orders of magnitude. It's always extrapolated in one way or another.
Right.
I just wondered if you had looked at, you know, what sort of uncertainties the concentration mass relation introduces into your predictions.
Not really along this line, but you know, I have another paper with Tomoaki based on his simulation, and then trying to understand those concentration mass relation using his simulation at the very small masses as well. I don't remember what the density was on top of my head, but that's mm-hmm. something we can in principle extract from that work.
It'd be interesting just to check that because. Yeah. You know, if that result is right and the redshift zero concentration mass relations are right, then you need a sort of physical mechanism to drop the density. The alternative is the density stays high, in which case the boost factor would wind up being a lot bigger, right?
Okay, good point. Thanks.
Okay, so in the interest of time, maybe let's stop the questions here. So let's thank Shinichiro again for his really interesting talk.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.